this is Doug Wheeler, and I'm back with From the Belly, and I'm so excited about tonight. Episode 20 was with Marvin Etzioni, and episode 21 was with Willie Aaron, and they make up the band The Holy Brothers. And tonight, I've got both of them on the line, which I've just been so looking forward to this. And so, guys, thanks for making yourself available.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for having us, Doug.
Really, really grateful. And it's fun to be on the outskirts of this this ride that you guys are on, because it's harvest time. I mean, you guys are bringing in the crop, man.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk a little bit about your last record, and we'll definitely get into the new record and what's coming, however much you want to talk about that. But I think before we do that, people are always interested with professional musicians to know, what are you guys listening to recently? And I thought I would even make it more specific. And I thought we all could share, what's the last record you listened to from front to back? Maybe it was vinyl, maybe it was a CD, but you know, you actually intentionally listened to the entire record because you just wanted to hear it again for the 100th time, or maybe for the first time.
I told Willie this a couple nights ago. I listened to the entire vinyl copy of Lady in Satin by Billie Holiday.
Wow.
The stereo mix. Yeah. And it was incredible. It's technically known as her last recording, but apparently it's her penultimate, because it was the last recording that came out while she was still alive. And then there was one other recording that she did afterwards, which I don't know. I think it's called The Last Recording, but Lady in Satin is known as her last album. You know, it's very, it's a very, very deep experience listening to Billie Holiday. It's not light entertainment. You know, you're not doing something else. It's all you're doing. It's just,
you're not doing something else.
Yeah.
You know. What compelled you to listen to that record at that time,
Martin? You know, what happened was, is that I took a walk in the morning and everything was shut down except one coffee shop. So I went inside the coffee shop, and three doors down from the coffee shop is a record store called Jackknife, which I love. Tons of used records, and the people who work there are just tremendous. But they've been closed during COVID this whole time. But there's a little section in the coffee shop that had like 10 albums, and one of them was Lady in Satin. I thought, boy, I'm really in the mood to listen to that record. So I just got it.
Wow, that's cool.
They had one copy of it.
You know? That's great.
Yeah.
You'd heard the record before?
I had, not the way that I listened to it this time. I'd heard it, but I was really wanted to make a conscious, you know, it was a beautiful pressing. And in fact, I just ordered a mono pressing of it so I could compare it. And in fact, I think the mono pressing has an additional song on it, so I'd like to get into that. And I didn't want to, for me, that's not the kind of record that I'm interested in listening to on CD. To me, that's like a vinyl only experience, at least for myself, you know.
You bet. Yeah.
The last record I listened to from start to finish, I sort of have this this ritual now that I pretty much listen to, you know, at least one, maybe two records, you know, before I go to bed. You know, not every night, but many nights. One of the things I've done during COVID is just sort of immerse myself in vinyl and sort of the whole history of music in a way. A few days ago, my girlfriend and I were watching the Frank Zappa documentary that just came out. And after watching that, highly recommended, by the way, really good. And, I listened to Hot Rats, which is, Zappa's first solo album, from late 1969. And I'm not someone who, I've had sort of like a love hate relationship with Zappa over the years. Like when I was a kid, there was, they used to have an annual fair at UCLA, you know, in in one of the big lots at UCLA. For years, they would have like these like little like a local fair, and they had a trivia contest. And one year I went, I must have been like 13 or 14, I think, which would have been like the mid 70s. And I won this trivia contest. And one of the prizes I won was this album called Zappa in New York. And I took it home, and it had a song called Titties and Beer of Zappa's. And it was a it was something that Dr. Demento used to play on his radio show. Mm-hmm. I don't know if anybody remembers Dr. Demento, but he,
yes,
you know, would play all these, you know, kind of crazy, funny novelty songs, you know, from the whole of the 20th century. Anyways, you know, after the sort of initial juvenile thrill of it, I kind of started to tire of Zappa's, what I thought was kind of a shticky juvenile, you know, sort of a, I just didn't connect to that kind of humor anymore. And I kind of gave up on him for a while. And then, I don't know, maybe 20, 25 years ago, I heard Hot Rats. I think a friend of mine said, this is the record that you, this is sort of the gateway, the entry point into his, you know, the considerable the body of work. And that record sort of still remains a deep favorite of mine, even though, you know, I don't love everything he's done, but, I definitely admire him as a, I mean, as a musician, yes, as a conceptualist, yes, but the interesting thing for me about Zappa is I think that he was singular. You know, there was nobody like him for good and for bad. There was nobody like him before or since. And I think that kind of individualism, that kind of bravery, artistic bravery, is really to be cherished and to be valued. And so, you know, even if you don't like his music,
yes,
there's an individual quality to it that I think Marvin and I both, you know, just I think we both respect and you know, in a way, we ourselves see ourselves as like individualists. I don't think that there's many people, without trying to sound arrogant, I just think that what we do is pretty singular. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I think that that's an inspiration. And that the movie, the Zappa doc that just came out, it's very, it was very well made by Alex.
Oh, Major. Good.
He's the director.
Because I'm not a huge Zappa fan either, but I saw the advertisement for that, and I'm attracted to that as well. Just the a respect for somebody who's willing to, as you said, to be singular. It's like, that's risky business.
Have you heard the record Hot Rats, Doug?
I have not.
Yeah, it's, you just got to listen to it from top to bottom. It's okay. Like no, it's like no other record that you have.
100% right.
Okay. You know, so if you discover that record, it's not like you can go, oh, I think I'll get another record that's kind of like, there is no other record like exactly like that. He has other records that came out before with the Mothers of Invention and afterwards.
That's where I've listened to most of his stuff.
Yeah, but Hot Rats holds a real particular place, and also it's very adventurous in terms of production and his use of tape manipulation and tape speed and speeding up tape sounds in drum sounds, and then against putting them against real time instruments. It's really great. Like, he uses the studio to a real extreme, possibly more so than anybody had ever used it before, because he wasn't really looking to identify a pop song. He was really experimenting in terms of sheer musicality. And
yes.
I would think his influences in classical music and jazz are probably even more prominent than his influences in rock and rock and roll, you know. So I would look to Zappa as a songwriter consultant, but in terms of record production and innovativeness, and as Willie used the word, I think an inspired way, individualism, I think that individualism, Billie Holiday had that. you know, Zappa had that. You know, I think that that's probably what unifies Willie and I, that we're attracted to. If you just say a certain name, you could say a two-syllable name. You know, you could say, you know, whoever that is, you know, Marvin Gaye, and all of a sudden it just conjures up a whole vibration of music and an entity because of this individual, because he stood for something, you know, and you sense that by just saying his or her name. And I think that's what all of these artists have in common that, that we connect to.
Yeah, that's, I would agree with that. Yeah, I think the thing that that like Marvin said that attracts us to these artists is they're not copycats. They have influences just like everybody, but the strength of their personalities is so strong and so clear that you can't help but be inspired by that. Mm-hmm. You know, I would hope that, you know, that people that hear what we do appreciate the fact that you could hear the influences, but that it's a singular thing that we're trying to accomplish, you know? And that's what I think listening to all these records and kind of immersing oneself in the history of, you know, of many forms of music, you start to kind of go, well, what sticks and what doesn't, and what, you know, there's things that I had heard when I was a kid that I loved that I don't really like, I don't really connect to so much anymore. And the opposite, there's things that I, that kind of passed me by when I was younger that I deeply connect to now. And I think that that's just sort of like part of the, you know, continually evolving process of a creative life where, you know, you can have your core influences, but you can also kind of, you know, you just start to kind of things that, you know, maybe like something like youthful energy that you, or, you know, some kind of strident position that you might've admired when you were a kid, you know, morphs into something else when you get older, you know?
Yes. Yes.
You know, or it doesn't have to be energy. Just, it's just whatever characteristic that, that you particularly cherish at that time in your life.
You know, when I remember when Hot Rats came out and friends were listening to the early Mothers records, and Zappa's, you know, his unique songwriting, a lot of it was abstract and nonsensical. And I remember it took an influence on me for a moment when I was a kid, like in junior high and high school. I remember writing a song called Elevator Cranberry. Like I would go out of my way to come up with songs that I didn't want them to make any sense. You know, it was like, if you understood it, I didn't, then I had succeeded, you know? And then I got hit by Plastic Ono Band and everything kind of shifted, you know? I appreciated that time and it kind of stays with me. I can listen to it with, you know, his work, you know, my favorite work by Zappa stands the test of time, but it definitely did have a moment of influence, you know, when I was taking in various forms of songwriting and trying to, you know, kind of figure it out, you know. And so I appreciated where Zappa stood, and I think he got the joke of rock and roll, you know. Mm-hmm, like he was in like one of my favorite movies is Head by the Monkees. He was in it, you know, and he got the joke of the Monkees. The Monkees got the joke of the Monkees, you know. Yeah, like the biggest band of the 60s from America, he was in on it, you know. And so I thought that was a real a phenomenal moment when he showed up in their film, and it's like this cross-pollinization of people that you think would never meet, Davy Jones and Frank Zappa, but they might have had more in common than meets the eye.
Interesting.
Right. I mean, also a very good friend of mine, a guy named Peter Lewis, who was the guitar player in a band from the 60s called Moby Grape. If you or any of your listeners have not heard the first Moby Grape album, It's one of the seminal 60s psychedelic, you know, records of all time. To me, my favorite album that ever came out of San Francisco, that one and Surrealistic Pillow by the Jefferson Airplane are to me the two pillars of that style of music. But the reason I bring Peter up, somebody who's a good friend of mine who I've played with over the years, he said something interesting to me. He said, you know, people felt that the 60s were all about peace and love. But he said to us in the counterculture, satire was as important as the message of peace and love. And satire, you know, is a, you know, that's a thing where you kind of like poke fun at whatever the quote establishment or the dominant culture is. And it was seen as a very healthy thing to do, to kind of like to
critique.
Yeah, to critique and to skewer. And Zappa was one of those guys who just like was a master at that. You know, he saw not just the flaws within, quote, straight society, but he also saw the folly in the hippie subculture. He saw like how dangerous and how disastrous the whole drug culture. He sort of saw, he was sort of ahead of his time in that regard. He saw that coming in a time when nobody did. Everybody thought, you know, that LSD, taking LSD, was going to save the world. And he saw the sort of the dark underbelly of it.
Wow. Guys, thank you. That was fantastic. And what a great name for an album, right? Hot Rats. Mm-hmm. What a great name.
Yeah. Well, that's what I meant. You know, I was attracted to that. Like, what does that mean? Right. You know what I mean? It was like, I knew it didn't mean anything, but I just loved that these words that had never been put together before were being put together. So as a kid, I was attracted to that.
You know, we might do a walk down memory lane quick, because when you were talking about satire and I was thinking about the 60s, one of my favorite shows, and it was one of the shows my parents would watch, and they were not watching much of the things that, I mean, they thought the Beatles were just going to, you know, take both my brother and I to hell. And I mean, they were
right.
They were afraid, right?
Sure.
And it was totally, but the show Laugh-In. I mean, you
absolutely.
Guys, that's right. That show, I'm telling
you. I had
you,
a right? feeling you were going to say Laugh-In.
Yeah, me too.
Oh, you did? Oh, yeah, that show. Too. My God, that show. It was so, I watched an episode recently. Man, it was so controversial.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they went for stuff in some ways more so. I don't know. I would have to watch it again and think about it in relationship to shows now that are trying to, you know, say something or trying to critique something or whatever. Well, you know, guys, let me throw the album that I listened to recently. And, I watched, I think it's on Netflix, the Keith Richards documentary. It was done a few years ago.
And I saw that one.
Okay. And it got me in a Stones mood. So I went and listened to, this was 2 days ago, I went and listened to Exile on Main Street.
The whole double album?
Not the whole double album.
Oh. So what'd you listen to, just disc one?
I listened to disc one.
Oh, okay. No one's going to, you know, knock on your door and take you to jail. I would probably send the cops over now for not listening.
I could tell. I could tell that you're thinking Doug's a lightweight, man.
Yeah,
Doug cheats.
Yeah.
Doug's a
it's
cheater.
It's okay. It's all right.
I love the record, though. At least I love half the record. And then I read some other things about where Mick Jagger was at that time and what he was wanting to do experimentally. And he was saying that he was bored with rock and roll and the whole deal. But you know, that album is, there's just something so raw. And I know that.
You know, why don't we just hold on?
Marvin, let me stop and go listen to it.
Finish it. What? Okay. What's the rush? I was just going to say real quick, there's a book called The Making of Exile.
Okay.
And it's talk about singular and individualism. I mean, there's really no record before and after that sounds like that. I think that there are probably a lot of bands that think that they sound like Exile on Main Street, but nobody does. It's just like one of those records that it didn't happen before Exile and it didn't happen after. It just didn't. There's no other record that sounds like Exile. There's this mud to it that is so attractive to where they were exploring and taking rock and roll. Because that if you had to define the Rolling Stones at that time, that was Keith Richards' band. That was rock and roll. That wasn't rock music. That was rock and roll. And it's dirty and it's disorientating. And it is the kind of recording that you're not quite sure what's going on. Sometimes you can't make out the lyrics, but you know, Charlie is swinging so deep and hard
on the tracks
that it gets you through it. And I think they took a chance releasing a double album. I remember as a kid, I actually created like a Best of Exile, you know, but now I appreciate it as a double album, you know, but it was a chancy thing. You know, they weren't the Beatles. It wasn't the White Album. It was something else. It was the Dark Album.
Yeah.
I remember the first time I heard Exile. I had read a lot of conflicting things about it. When it came out originally, a lot of people didn't know what to make of it, because the album that had come out before Exile was Sticky Fingers, which had Brown Sugar and had Wild Horses and had Bitch and had all, you know, Can't You Hear Me Knocking. It was a very like consistent album, you know, full of these sort of great grooves and it was very punchy and very immediate, you know, a very visceral record. I'm talking about Sticky Fingers.
Right.
And then, you know, plus Brown Sugar was an AM hit as well as an FM hit, huge, you know, record for them. Then, you know, they go to France, you know, for tax purposes, and they go and they record this, like Marvin said, this murky, muddy, sort of jumble of ideas. You know, there's some slow blues, there's country blues, there's, yep. You know, there's a, you know, the swinging stuff like Rip This Joint. Obviously Tumbling Dice, you know, was probably the most well-known song from that record. But like, that's a record that I struggled, you know, to really embrace when I was younger. And then when I was going on, when I was touring with my old band, The Balancing Act, we had brought a copy of it in the van, and side one, I mean, I think it might be like one of my favorite sides of music by anyone. Mm. It's just from the beginning of Rocks Off to the end of Tumbling Dice. You know, there's just not a bad note in that entire sequence of music.
And if there is a bad note, who gives a fuck?
Exactly. I just mean, you know, even, yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah. If you don't like it, then yeah. You know, put on the Carpenters. What can I tell you?
No, I mean, I love that record, and that kind of mud of it is very attractive, and I think that, you know, it stands alone. Again, talking about individualism, there's no other Stone, let alone other records. There's no other Stones record that sounds like that one either.
Yes. And Marvin, you can throw me a bone. At least I was honest when you asked me, did you listen?
I would have been able to tell.
Yeah, you probably would have. Well, let me ask you guys about the when, why, and how of the Holy Brothers. When, why, and how did you guys come together? And then we're going to dive into your first album that was recently released on a bunch of different platforms, which I was so excited about. How about the when, why, and how of the Holy Brothers? There's some stories.
You know, Marvin and I have known each other for, I'm now counting in my head, 42 years. And when I was 15, going to high school at Fairfax High, and going on my lunch break or sometimes cutting class across the street to Aaron's Records to buy albums. You know, Aaron's was just all of LA back then in the late 70s was just a for a young music fan like myself, it was just bursting with, you know, clubs, record stores, magazines, wow. Bands.
The energy must have just been.
For me, it was just like, it was just, you know, it was a lot to take in. And Aaron's just was a place where they had an amazing used 29 cent and 99 cent section. And I built up a lot of my record collection from buying those records. And I remember my best friend for years, Dave Sawyers, he and I would go to Aaron's almost like a ritual, like a daily ritual during our lunch break. If we weren't getting fried rice from the Chinese restaurant, you know, block away. And one day we were browsing and the school bell rings, 1 o'clock, and which you could hear the school bell ring from Aaron's because the high school is only across the street. And Dave says, "Hey, it's 1 o'clock. We got to get back to class." And they were right. It was right in the middle of they were right in the middle of playing The Who live at Leeds, which I loved. Mm-hmm. And The Who were absolutely one of my favorite bands back then. Mm-hmm. And I said, "We can't leave. We're right in the middle of live at Leeds." And then I hear this voice that says, "There's somebody who likes good records." And I look up, and there was Marvin. He was working. He was working as a clerk. As a record store clerk at the store. And, you know, he was a little bit older than me. And we just sort of like had this immediate bond. And he lived not far from the store. So I would, you know, I'd go home with him sometimes. He'd play me songs. As long as I've known him, he was always writing songs from the beginning. It wasn't a thing where, like, you know, you go jam with somebody when you're a teenager or when you're young and, you know, you play other people's songs. Marvin from the get-go was always writing songs, and I'd sing harmony, you know, to the songs that, you know, that he'd written. And
So you guys were doing, I mean, you were doing some stuff then.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah, for sure. And then, you know, we'd sort of track each other's, you know, we had these parallel musical lives. Marvin had joined Lone Justice and helped to kind of like steer that whole vision of that band in the early 80s. Marvin had produced my first band, Blue Monday, with my friend Dave. He produced our Lone demo tape. And then Marvin also had recommended my name to a guy named Jeff Davis, who was starting a band called The Balancing Act. Originally, they were called The Art Students. And so, you know, Marvin has just been like, you know, not beyond a mentor. He's just been like an absolutely crucial, you know, musical and spiritual presence and friend and brother, literally, you know, like a holy brother in my life. And so we've kind of tracked each other's, you know, lives and careers and stuff. And, you know, both belong to the same synagogue, and the rabbi at the synagogue, Mordecai Finley, who's another just brilliant, brilliant mind, brilliant rabbinic mind, and moral, a moral theoretician, just incredible person. During the service, when you walk around, part of the Sabbath ritual is you walk around with the Torah, which is the Hebrew Bible. And as we're walking, Marvin and I were, you know, standing next to each other, and Rabbi Finley looks at us and he goes, "The Holy Brothers. It's the Holy Brothers."
Wow.
Am I telling this correctly,
yeah.
Marvin?
Okay, yeah. Good. I was just good. And that was the moment Willie and I looked at each other and it was like, well, all we got to do is make a record.
were you doing much stuff then? I mean, were you in the studio?
We were always doing stuff, but I think that was the moment of crystallization. All of a sudden, it's like, oh, we're the Holy Brothers. All right, let's go make a record. And then, like, you know, Willie knew is like, well, I got a song. You know, how many you want? You know, so we went in the studio, started recording. One song led to another. All of a sudden, you know. I call Willie up. Hey, I got this other song. And then I remember one time I wrote, "My Name is Sparkle." And I played that for him over the phone and he go, "Oh, well, we got to record that song, you know?" And it just started to kind of take a shape and a form for me as a songwriter and also as an artist for the kind of record that I always wanted to make, but I never fully went there. And so that was really the beginning of it, you know, that something happened, you know, in that moment. It's just one of those, you know, had he said, you know, hey, it's something else, we might have been called something else, but we just stuck with it, you know. But it kind of defined what was about to happen, you know. And what? So it was a very memorable moment, at least for me. Yeah.
And the name of the album, for those that are listening, is My Name is Sparkle, which is the first track on the album. So, Marvin, when you said it was you had wanted to make, or always wanted to make, a record like this, so how do you guys represent this record? If somebody says, so, like, what, not so much what's the record about, but it's like, what makes this record unique to you guys? What did you do differently? How did you approach it differently? We're going to talk about a few tracks from it, and then folks can go listen to it on a bunch of different platforms. You can get on Spotify and iTunes and Apple Music, and that just came out in November, at least on Spotify, which,
yeah,
was
it's
really
not
cool.
On all. You can it's get all. It if you're listening. You can get the album My Name is Sparkle on any digital platform.
That's right. That's
you
right.
Like, mm-hmm. To listen to music too. I think that the album, at least for myself, represents a particular time where, you know, I was on a mission of wanting to go deeper into my relationship with God and the songs. And then there, a concept came through, the character Sparkle, who I wanted to make sure that in the song, Sparkle is never identified as a man or a woman, a boy or girl. We don't really know. And I connected that androgynousness about the character Sparkle, that it could be anybody, it could be any one of us, it could be a stranger, it could be someone that we know. But what's really interesting is that some years ago, when, you know, when I wrote the song and then we recorded it, you know, we were really kind of out on a limb. We were kind of alone, you know, and I really feel like now we're getting much more attention than ever, saying, wow, we really need this message in our lives right now. And that is not what was happening, you know, maybe 3-4 years ago when we were playing. People came to the shows, we got a, you know, great response, but sometimes the response would be, you know, Marvin, there's a lot of songs about God on this album, you know, like that's not a subject, you know, let's not talk about that. It's like, well, that's what the album's about. Yeah. It's like, what can I tell you? I'm not going to take back the disc and re-record it to accommodate anybody.
As you said, if you don't like it, you can go listen to the Carpenters.
Well, I like the Carpenters.
And I do too.
I mean?
Let's
yeah.
go
yeah.
ahead
you
know and we, I mean? Let's go yeah. ahead and say that we're not dissing on that.
No. I like the Carpenters. I like Zappa. The thing, here's the thing, you know, it's like, there's no conflict, you know, to like, you know, Zappa and the Carpenters and Miles Davis and Aaron Copland and Marvin Gaye, you know, and Run DMC, you know, it's like, it's all coming from the same well, you know? So that to me is what the connection, that's mm-hmm. what connects Willie and I. We're not looking to create one particular little facet, you know? It's like, we might get together tomorrow or a new song. You know, we recorded two songs last Saturday, and then Sunday morning I played Willie a new song that was completely a song that was much more, you know, Curtis Mayfield or something, you know, a soul record. And it was like, he said, we don't have anything like this, you know, for the second album. You know, so we never know what we're about to get into. I never know what we're about to get into. I'm not looking to just create one particular thing. But the album, the Sparkle album, we took a stand on it. I'm glad we took the stand on it, because I think in the time that we're in, I think that people, you know, I'm finding that people need a voice, someplace to go and say, I need to, there's something more, you know, that I need to connect to than just the headline news 24/7 of what's going on right now. Mm. I need something to listen to, some place to feel that there's something beyond the reach of my hands. And so that to me is what our music represents. If you connect to it, that's fantastic. And maybe you'll get into it tonight. Maybe you're into it. Maybe you'll find it another point in your life, you know, but we're going to keep going. We're working on our second album. We're coming up with songs for our third album. We're going to keep doing this.
Yep.
This is what we do.
Beautiful.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah. That's the real key right there is, you know, when the album first, when we first dropped the album, we gave it to a friend of mine, who's a screenwriter. And, you know, he calls me up maybe a few days after, you know, after we came out, and he goes, hey, I got something for you. Are you home? You know, I said, sure. He said, can I, you know, bring you something? I go, sure. He comes back to the house and he brings the album back to me. He you know, he gives it back to me and he goes, you know, I've looked the songs, the singing, the playing, the writing, it's all great. You know, I cannot relate to anything with God in it. I just, you know, it's just like, I can't. And you know, look, I could have crumbled in a heap. I could have said, fuck you. I could have, you know, done anything. All that did was just sort of strengthen my resolve, you know, and you know, reinforce it with Marvin too, that we are, you know, we're out on a limb doing it ourselves. Are we the first people that have ever put, you know, put the word God in music? No. Are we going to be the last? Certainly no, certainly not. We're not evangelists of any sort. We're just raising questions and bringing some thoughts out into the world. And, you know, for some people, they're just not, they don't want to deal with it. They want, you know, they want musical aspirin, or they want something else. They want an escape. And there's nothing wrong with it.
I was just going to say that maybe that same person would want to hear that now. You know, the song, the record is what it is, and we change around that. So, you know, so sometimes you might hear something at one point in your life, you don't connect to it. All of a sudden, a little time passes, and you do, something has happened. Or it could go the other way, you know. Sometimes you go, why did I even bother listening to that music? I don't connect to it right now, you know. So, you know, as an artist, we can't follow every single person or every comment that's made about what we do. I think we just have to keep doing what we do, believe what we believe in. And if people can get what we do, folks like yourself, Doug, and Caleb, your son, I really get that you guys truly get it, you know? And yeah. So there's a connection that's forged, and all of a sudden it's like that's beginning to grow and develop as people hear what we're doing. And to me, that's really exciting, you know? And it's like, Willie knows me. I don't like to stand still. If someone says, wow, I really like what you did, it's like, I'm off writing another song. Go, well, I gotta try something else here. You know?
And for somebody like me, I feel very privileged to, you know, be, you know, an active observer and participant in that creative restlessness and quest for not standing still. I think I admire that in all, you know, most of the artists that I treasure. I think Marvin would probably say the same thing. But I love the fact that like this is a living, breathing entity that doesn't trade on nostalgia, and it doesn't trade on, you know, on like, oh, we're gonna just like, you know, keep doing, you know, these same 10 songs for the next, you know, 20, 30 years. And you know, some artists have one bag of songs in them. Some people have one great song in them.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that. But Marvin just, he keeps writing these gems, you know, and it's like a spigot that just will not turn off.
Mm.
And I mean, I just feel myself just very privileged to be, you know, part of that process. And Marvin entrusts me with, you know, he's like, hey, I got this new song. I'm going to send it to you, or I'll play it for you over the phone. And, you know, we're 42 years deep into this friendship that has only grown and strengthened and gotten stronger. And, you know, we don't have the, we don't have that thing of like, you know, trying to be anything less than 100% truthful to each other, you know? So if Marvin plays me a piece of music and he'll say, do you think this is for the Holy Brothers? And I'll say yes or no, you know? Mm-hmm. And Marvin doesn't get offended. He's like, you like this one? Great. For the Holy Brothers, great. If not, you know, I'll record it, you know, for myself or whatever. And if you know, here's another one. How's this one? Is this a Holy Brothers song? You know, and it's just like, I love being able to, you know, in a way, like, I know that it's a Holy Brothers song if I can slot myself in and I can put my voice to it. And if I can sing harmony to it and I can inject my own personality into it, then I know that it's the proper vehicle for the Holy Brothers.
Willie, that's a great, great segue into before. There's two tracks on the record that I want to do a little deep dive into. Because I'm very drawn to not only the instrumentation and musicality of any good record, but also lyrics. I mean, that's where I learned to read. I struggled in school. I mean, I graduated from high school. I'd never read a full book from start to finish.
Wow.
I really struggled with reading, but I read liner notes. I mean, that's where, in some ways, that's kind of, well, I don't know if I learned to read there. I learned to read in grade school, of course, but I did what I was interested in, and I was so interested. I mean, you know what it was like to wait for an album to come out. I mean, sometimes you didn't even know something was coming out. Right. Mm-hmm. And you just go to the record store and there it was. And you just couldn't believe. And you'd look at the dates. You'd be like, oh, my gosh, this is the most recent album. And you'd be able to take that home and open it up. I mean, it was like a Christmas gift every time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all the many times a poster would come out of it. But I would always be so deflated if the lyrics were not included in the album. I would always, because all, you know, you had the radio to listen to, but I would read them, just pour over them like poetry. But so before we jump into two songs off the record, Willie, a great segue into the role you play in the band, or at least the way you show up. I went to, and by the way, folks listening, if you want to get up close and personal, with Marvin and Willie, go to YouTube and just click on The Holy Brothers, and you'll get some songs off the record. Maybe every song was covered through Vimeo, through videos, but it's with Tomorrow Pictures TV. And man, a shout out to them because it's beautiful work. And so it's little snippets of a song, and then Willie and Marvin will just share their thoughts about themselves or what was going on in the time of making the song.
So Willie, I just wanted to add something, if you guys don't mind. You know, Frederick is a director friend of ours from Atlantic, who's part of Tomorrow Pictures, and our friends there, Ellen, and, you know, everyone who works there. But Frederick, over the last few years, has really been a very, very unique influence on us. At first, he saw us and he just started filming us, and he goes, I want to do a doc about you guys. And I didn't really think one way or the other. It's like, well, that's really nice. But then all of a sudden, we started to, over the past year, the relationship and the connection got really deep. Like, he started to get really into the songs and then realized that what we were trying to do over the last few years was really, we were going for something in a spiritual way in the context of what I'd say, let's just say, call it classic songwriting, just for a better term. But his influence on us, he's like, to me, like one of the Holy Brothers, you know?
Absolutely,
like,
right. That's, you know, absolutely right.
And so he's not just some guy with a camera that shows up and then, oh, he sends us a clip. It's like, we've spent hours over, you know, over the last year or two talking with Freddie, either on the phone or Zoom, whatever it is. And so I'm so grateful to that friendship and relationship. And, you know, he'll turn me on to things. I'll turn him on to things, and Willie will do the same. And something is happening with what Freddie's trying to do, not only with the Holy Brothers, but just on his whole point of view. He's doing this doc about this trans person who's like 9 years old. Hmm. Freddie played the song My Name is Sparkle to this young trans person, and she totally flipped out over the song. Her parents flipped out over the song. All of a sudden, I felt like, wow, we have people who understand what we're trying to do.
Wow.
And it was really exciting. And he was incorporating that influence into what we were doing. So I can't say enough that I'm a really big believer in like one person can totally change the dynamic when you're making a record or when you're working with someone. It's not a casual thing, you know, to be doing this with Freddie. So he's definitely a part of what we're doing. And I wanted to not just allow his name and his company mention is like, oh, that's just a sidebar. That is the bar.
Well, it must come through the work, right? Because I mean, the videos themselves are it's beautiful, yeah, beautiful work.
Yeah. Frederick is a, he's a visionary. I don't mean that in a pretentious way. I mean it in a very real way. The way that he sees the space where culture and race and art kind of come together, you know, sort of like the cultural politics of the day, and activism. He just has his nose to the street, you know, in a very compelling way. And, you know, he lives, he splits his time between Georgia and Tennessee. He's between Atlanta. He's mostly Atlanta based. And now he also has operations in Nashville. But, you know, he was there in Atlanta when all of the unrest was taking place this summer. All the racial unrest, and Frederick's African American, and he is very close with the King family, he just, you know, he's filmed you know, some funerals of some of the slain people mm. that were the victims of police violence in Atlanta, and you know, he sees in us like. I think he sees like a real brotherhood moment where he just sees us as kindred spirits in this kind of cultural fight to you know, just sort of to stand up to this polarization that's ripped the country apart. And, you know, he always says, look, you know, Blacks and Jews need to stick together. We need to, you know, defy the whatever other political division is out there in the world right now. We just have to kind of shut that noise out and just band together and know that we are, you know, we're trying to kind of do our part to make the culture, you know, better. And, you know, again, I'm not trying to be pretentious at all when I say that. I say it with every fiber of truth that I can muster. And I know Fred, I know Fred feels the same way.
Here's an interesting thing about Freddie is that you can correct me if I'm wrong, Willie, but about 7-8 years ago, I'd written a song called Lift You Up. I send it to Freddie and I didn't hear anything about it. One of those songs I had played for Willie, he was like, yeah, okay, good song. I was going to put it on my solo album.
Mm-hmm.
And then last year, over the last year, Freddie called Willie, says, have you heard this song? Apparently, it just came on play, like on random, like it just showed up.
Oh, wow.
And all of a sudden, Freddie really connected to the song with what was going on over this past year. So he called Willie and said, you know, this could be a Holy Brothers song. Like all of a sudden, he had a vision for it, and he had the vision to bring in a voiceover actor who does the voice for Martin Luther King, a brilliant voiceover actor who does Martin Luther King Jr.'s voice. He does like the I Have a Dream speech, and incredible. So Freddie recorded him on our song, speaking the lyrics from the song as if it was Martin Luther King.
Yes, I heard it.
And so that was Freddie's influence. Wow. I didn't come up with that. Willie and I didn't talk about it. All of a sudden, but we all worked together. He recorded it. We brought it in. That song has gone through like four different studios. And today we finally have the mastered single that we're going to put out for Martin Luther King Day in 2021 in January. And we're finalizing the cover. We're doing all this. But the point I'm making is that when you can find one other person in your life that can have a deep impact on you, that is not a casual thing. That can change everything for you.
Wow.
I just wanted to share all that. That's a big part of what we're going through and what's happening.
Please join us next week for part two of this conversation with Marvin Etzioni and Willie Aaron of The Holy Brothers.